one of my favorite agadot. It's a difficult agadah. It's not a happy agadah. I will try. And I don't have a translation, so I'm going to start out reading it with you, just kind of reading and translating, checking for basic comprehension, just to make sure everybody knows what's going on. And then we'll have a little time for you to sort of discuss with your tables, and then we'll sort of come together and talk a bit about it. Okay? It's an agadah story, a Talmudic story. When I say we're going to come together and talk about it, what it means is you'll talk a little and I'll also sort of do a shiur. So don't have expectation of just, you know, sort of open-ended discussion. That's not really what's going to happen. But there'll be a little of that. Okay, so here's the agadah. I'm going to pass this around. And again, apologies that there's no translation, or maybe not apologies that there's no translation. Not sure. There you go. Okay. This Agadah comes from Masechet Sanhedrin. If there's anything I say that you don't know what I mean, don't let me pass go. Don't pass go, whatever. Just interrupt me. Okay? You don't have to like raise your hand and just say, I don't know what that means. You know, it's okay. First of all, just before we start, raise your hand if you're familiar with the story of Tanur Shalachnai. Okay, good. So I know some of you are not. It will come up in this story, and also the main characters in the story, some of the main characters in that story. So those of you who know, keep in the background. Does anybody not have a handout? Here we go. Okay, at the top of the page. The story that we're going to read is inside the rectangle. Okay, the story comes up as part of a discussion of the Mishnah, which is at the top of the page. This Mishnah is from the 7th chapter of Sanhedrin. It's from the very end of the chapter. Sanhedrin, the first few chapters of the tractate talk about civil and criminal procedure and punishment. And the rest of the tractate lists the laws, violation of which makes you subject to one or another form of capital punishment, and one of those is witchcraft, mechashef. Mm-hmm. Okay? So this Mishnah is talking about the law of the mechashef, of the person who does witchcraft, and it says, mechashef, one who does witchcraft, ha'osem ha'aseh chayav v'lo ha'ocheiz et einayim. If a person actually does something by means of witchcraft, really makes something happen by means of witchcraft, then that person is chayav, and the person is, can you say chayav? Liable to punishment. V'lo ha'ocheiz et ha'einayim, but not one who merely, literally grabs the eyes, meaning not one who simply creates an illusion. So, you know, those rabbits that come out of the hat, right? I don't know how they do it, I'm sure some of you do, right? But presumably that's actually an illusion. You didn't actually, you know, create a rabbit out of garlic, right? That's achizat einayim, and that kind of magic does not make you liable, right? Only if you posem ase, only if you actually did something through witchcraft. Okay. Rabbi Akiva, Omer Mishum Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Akiva said in the name of Rabbi Yehoshua, one of his teachers, Shnaim loktim kishuin, echad loket patur ve'echad loket chayav. Hosema sechayav, holchezet hainayim, patur. So Rabbi Akiva said in the name of his teacher, Rabbi Yehoshua, two people can be gathering cucumbers in the field. Two people can be gathering cucumbers. One gatherer could be exempt from punishment, and the other could be liable to punishment. How so? Hosema sechayav, right? The person who actually gathered cucumbers through some kind of magic or witchcraft would be liable, but the one who merely created an illusion of gathering cucumbers would be patur, would be exempt from punishment. Okay, that is the Mishnah on which the Gemara brings the story that we're going to read. Okay? So we'll start with a sentence right above where the box starts, the sentence that's not in the box. Because I want you to see the context in which the story comes up. Right? This is not just the Gemara saying, well, I have a nice story about cucumbers. Right? The Gemara raises this story as part of a question that it wants to ask. And the question that it asks is, V'ha Rabbi Akiva me Rabbi Yoshua gamir la? Is it really the case that Rabbi Akiva gamir, Rabbi Akiva learned, same word as Gemara, that Rabbi Akiva learned this law from Rabbi Yoshua? As we saw in the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva transmits this law in the name of his teacher, Rabbi Yoshua. Is that really true, that he learned it from Rabbi Yoshua? V'ha Tanya, but after all, we learn the following thing in a Braita. Okay? And so what you see is that the whole story that's inside the box is a story that's being brought as part of an apparent contradiction to the Mishnah, meaning that this story will actually show that it's not from Rabbi Yoshua that Rabbi Akiva learned this law, but rather from somebody else. Okay? Now, you can sort of park that in the back of your mind, and now we're just going to focus in on the story. We'll get back to the frame of the story much later on. Okay, so now we're going to focus on the story. Again, if there's anything that's not clear, I don't mean in the deep sense right now. We can get to deep later. I mean in the most basic comprehension sense. Let me know. Okay? So here goes. Kishachala Rabbi Eliezer, nichnasu Rabbi Akiva v'chaverav levakro. When Rabbi Eliezer became ill, and generally speaking, and certainly in this context, we're referring to an illness that put somebody on his bed. When Rabbi Eliezer became ill, nichnasu Rabbi Akiva v'chaverav levakro, Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues came in to visit him. He was sitting in his kinuf. Kinuf is like a, what do you call those things? Beds with canopies, right? What do you call those things? What?
Four post.
Canopy
bed. Canopy bed
is actually a canopy bed. Okay, so he's sitting in that, right? And there are sitting in his triclinium. Triclinium is the sort of rabbinicized form of triclinium, which would be our parlor or living room, right? It's the room that you enter in, not the bedroom. So he's in his room, let's say, and they're in the living room. And that day was Erev Shabbat. And Hyrcanus, his son, meaning Rabbi Eliezer's son, entered in lachlotz tefilav, to take off his father's tefillah. Rabbi Eliezer yelled at him, he scolded him. And Hyrcanus, Rabbi Eliezer's son, left. Nizifa is a very strong word, sort of abashed, ashamed, rejected. We'll get back to that word later, but it's a very strong feeling of having been kicked out. Amar lehen lechaverav. So Hyrcanus said to his colleagues, it would appear to me that father's mind has become deranged. Amar lahan, so Rabbi Eliezer overheard what his son had said, and he says to them, "Dato v'dat imo nitrafa." It's his mind and his mother's mind that have been deranged. Heach benichim isur skila, those kin b'isur shvut. How is it that they are setting aside a prohibition that carries with it the punishment of stoning, and instead they're occupying themselves with Isur Shvut, means a mere rabbinic prohibition on Shabbat. Now, what's being referred here is not 1,000% clear, but presumably what's being referred to is that before Shabbat, there are things that you have to do in order to make sure that you don't end up really violating Shabbat in a d'oraita way. For example, perhaps making sure that the fire is lit, making sure that your food is cooked, making sure that there's light in the house or whatever, because those are things that you can't do on Shabbat under pain of violating a Torah law, which brings with it, classically, the punishment of stoning. So how is it that they're sort of ignoring, setting aside those really important things that they should be occupying themselves with, and instead occupying themselves with something that is merely a rabbinic prohibition, which presumably refers to the practice not to wear tefillin on Shabbat? Like, why are they so eager to take off my tefillin when there's more important things they should be doing before Shabbat? That seems to be what he's saying. When the sages saw that his mind was miyushevet alav, sort of settled upon him, meaning that his mind was not nitrafa, his mind was not deranged, rather his mind was kind of the way it usually is, they entered and they sat before him, meaning they left the living room, so went into his room, and they sat before him four amot, four cubits distance. So they're sitting in his room, but they're sitting, let's say, 6-8 feet away from him, 4 amot away from him. Amalaha, lama batem. He says to them, why have you come? Amrulo lilmot Torah banu. So they said to him, we've come to learn Torah. Amalahem v'adachshav lama lo batem. So he says to them, then why haven't you come up till now? Amrulo lo hayalanu pnai. They said, we just didn't get a chance. We didn't have any. We didn't have time to come. Amarlahem, he said to them, Tmiani im yamutu mitat atzman. It would be surprising to me. I would be amazed, right, if these people die a natural death. Amarlo Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva says to him, Shelimahu. What about me? What will be my end? Marlo shalcha kashem ishalahen. He says to him, your end will be even worse than theirs. Natal shtei zorotav v'hinichan al libo. Rabbi Eliezer took his two arms and he rested them on his heart. Amar or lachem shtei zorotai shehin ki shtei sifrei Torah sheniglalim. He said, woe to you, my two arms, which are like two sifrei Torah that are rolled up. Harbei Torah limadati, Harbei Torah limadati, v'harbei Torah limadati. Harbei Torah limadati, v'lo chisarti mirabotai afilu kekelef hamilakek min hayam. Harbei Torah limadati, v'lo chisuni talmidai ela kimichol b'shroferet. I have learned a lot of Torah, and I have taught a lot of Torah. I've learned a lot of Torah, but I haven't taken away or diminished, we'll get back to that word later, I haven't diminished from my masters even as much as a dog lapping up water from the sea. I've taught a lot of Torah, but my students have not diminished me except for, right, the amount of, and you have to sort of imagine, do they still have mascara tubes nowadays? Does mascara still come in tubes?
Yes.
Yeah. So that refers to like a little makeup tube with like a brush or something, a stick that that you take the makeup with, right? So my students haven't diminished me except as the amount of like a makeup brush and a mascara tube. Just that much. Below od, ela sha'ani shoneh shalosh me'ot halachot b'baheret azah, v'lo haya adam sh'sha'alani b'hem davar me'olam, and not only that, but I teach, meaning I have in my repertoire, right, I teach 300 halachot, 300 laws on the topic of Baheret Azah. Baheret Azah is a particular kind of leprous spot, right? There's different kinds of leprosy. This is one particular kind of leprous spot. I teach 300 laws concerning this particular kind of leprous spot, and nobody ever has asked me a thing about it. V'lo od, אלא שאני שונה 300 הלכות, ואמילה 3,000 הלכות בנטייה קישואין, ולא היה אדם שואלני בהם דבר מעולם חוץ מעקיבא בן יוסף. Not only that, but I teach 300 laws, and then the narrative says, there's another tradition that what he said was, I teach 3,000 laws about the planting of cucumbers, and nobody ever asked me a thing about that, except for Akiva ben Yosef. Who we know is Rabbi Akiva. Pamachat, aniva hu mehalchim hayinu baderech. One time, I and he were walking on the way. Amar li Rebbe, lamdeni v'netiya kishuin. He said to me, Rebbe, teach me about the planting of cucumbers. Amarti devar achad, nitma'a kal hasadeh kishuin. I spoke something, and the entire field was filled with cucumbers. Amar li, Akiva said to me, Rebbe, Rebbe, you've taught me how to plant them. Now teach me how to uproot them. I spoke something, and all of them gathered, all of them were gathered to one place. Amrula, so his visitor said to him, Hakadur v'haimus v'hakamia v'tzor ha-magulayot v'mashkola k'tana mahu. Mahu is rabbinic language for what is the law. Okay? What is the law with respect to these five items? What are these five items? Kadur is a ball. Emus is a shoemaker's last, or a form on which a shoemaker shapes a shoe. A kamiya is a kamiya, an amulet. Okay? Suar Margoliot is a bundle of pearls, and Mashkal Ketana is a small weight. Okay, what is the law with respect to these items? We'll talk more if we get a chance to hear about what these items are all about, but what is the law with respect to them specifically? The law that they're asking about is, are these items susceptible to contracting impurity? Right, as you all know, there's a system of purity and impurity. There are several kinds of things that transmit impurity, but not everything can contract impurity. For example, a branch that falls off a tree cannot contract impurity. Right? Things have to be in certain states. Only certain kinds of things can contract impurity. And they're asking him, can these five things contract impurity? Amar lahem heint me'in v'taharatan b'mashahem. He said to them, they are impure, meaning they are susceptible to contracting impurity. V'taharatan b'mashahem. And they can become pure again. They can become purified, presumably by dipping in the mikvah, by immersing in the mikvah, b'mashahem, just as they are. And we'll get back to exactly what that's about later. Min al sh'al gabei haimusmahu. So then they ask him, well, what's the law concerning a shoe on a last? Right, they had asked him about the last, now they're asking about a shoe on the last. A brief word about what the issue is there. A piece of leather, right, cannot contract impurity. On the other hand, something made out of a piece of leather, like a shoe, right, can contract impurity. Okay, a piece of metal, right, can contract impurity. A piece of metal fashioned into a sword or a fork, perhaps, can contract impurity. Okay, and the question sometimes arises: at what point in the manufacturing process, right, do we consider the manufacturing of the raw material to be complete, such that that object could now be susceptible to contracting impurity? Okay, so here we have, let's say, a shoemaker. He's taken his leather, he's fashioned it into a shoe, right? He's about to take it off the last and put it in his door window, right? The shoe, the making of the shoe is complete, but he hasn't yet removed it from the last. Okay? So the question they're asking him is, do we consider that to be the end of the process of manufacture, such that this thing is susceptible to contracting impurity? Or no, since it hasn't been removed from the last yet, it's not yet susceptible. So that's the question. Min al sh'al gabei hamusmahu, a shoe on the last, what is the law? Amar lahem hu tahor. Right, that thing is pure, meaning that thing is not susceptible to contracting impurity. V'yatza nishmato v'tahara. His breath, his soul, spirit, departed impurity, in purity. Amad Rabbi Yoshua al raglav v'amar hutar haneder. Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet and he said, the oath has been annulled. The oath has been annulled. I'll explain what that means in a minute. L'motzei Shabbat pagabo Rabbi Akiva min Kesari lulud haya makeh b'vsoro ad shedomo shotet la'aretz. On Motzei Shabbat, Rabbi Akiva met up with him between Caesarea and Lud. Presumably, he meets up with Rabbi Eliezer's bier being carried for burial. And Rabbi Akiva was striking his flesh until his blood was pouring down onto the ground. Patach alav b'shura. Rabbi Akiva spoke first in the shura. The shura is the line of mourners or the line that stands around the mourners at a burial service. Patach alav b'shura v'amar avi avi rechav Yisrael ufarashav. Rabbi Akiva said, father, father, chariot of Israel and his horsemen. This is quoting, what is this quoting? We'll say 2 Kings 2.
Elisha.
Yes, right. This is what Elisha says when his master Eliyahu is conveyed up to the heavens. Avi avi rechav Yisrael ufarashav. Harbe ma'ot yesh li ve'ein li shulchani l'hartzotam. I have so many coins, but I have no, a shulchani is a money changer. I have no money changer who can help me with it, who can help me make change. Okay, that's the story. Let me start by clarifying a few things myself, and then I'll open it up to any clarification, not discussion questions, but clarification questions. So a couple things I want to clarify. First of all, those who do know the Tanur Shel Achanai story, I'm not going to tell it, but very briefly, there is a situation where Rabbi Eliezer disagrees with the sages about a law, and does not give in to them, and not only that, brings all sorts of kind of supernatural proofs to his point of view. And at a certain point in that story, he is put into excommunication. And more things happen in that story, which I'm not going to talk about right now. I just want to point out that it's clear that this story is to be seen, at least in part, as a sequel to that story. And there are actually three strong indications of that, which are very important to keep in mind. The first one is that when the sages, at the beginning of the second paragraph inside the rectangle, when the sages enter Virgilius's presence, as opposed to sitting in the living room, right, they enter, but they sit for a moment. Sit four cubits away. And this is a practice that has to do with excommunication. In fact, back in that Tanur Shalach Nai story, when Rabbi Eliezer is told by his student Rabbi Akiva that he's been excommunicated, the way Rabbi Akiva indicates that is by coming to visit him but sitting four cubits away. Okay. Secondly, in the last line of the second to last paragraph, right, which is the exact parallel place in the story. Right? The story kind of has a kind of ABCVA structure, kind of chaotic structure. So the last line in the second to last paragraph is right, so parallel to the first line of the second paragraph. So there it says, Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet and says, Hutar Haneder, Hutar Haneder, right? Which refers presumably to the vow of excommunication. In other words, we find out at the beginning of the story that whereas we don't know whether 6 months or 30 years have passed since the Tanur Shalach Nai story where Rabbi Eliezer was excluded from the rabbinic community, we have no idea how long has passed. And we find out, perhaps to our surprise, that actually he is still under the state of excommunication. Right? They come to visit him, but sit for a month away. And at his death, Rabbi Yeshua declares the vow of excommunication annulled, or rather perhaps reflects on the fact that it has been annulled. And not only that, but the language Amad Rabbi Yeshua Arablav Amar, Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet and said, those who are really familiar to the Tanur Shalach Nai story know that this phrase appears there. Okay? What does he say when he stands on his feet in the Tanur Shalach Nai story? Right. Rabbi Yeshua stands on his feet and says, Lo Bashamayim Hi. For a lot of people, that's kind of the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. Okay. Or, and, you know, a line later where God's like laughing about that, right? It doesn't matter if Rabbi Eliezer gets a heavenly voice to come down and affirm and confirm the validity of his position. It's not in heaven. Okay? So this is also a phrase that that appears in that story. So I just want to sort of point that out as a backdrop. The story is not a self-contained story, albeit the frame of it. The story is a story about people we know. We know these people from a whole host of rabbinic stories. And not only that, but it is presenting itself as something that ought to be read in the context of the excommunication of Rabbi Eliezer that happens in the Tanur Shalach Nai story. Okay, I'm going to stop here. I want to know, does anybody have any questions? Just clarification, like what's going on? Yes, and say your name.
Eliana.
Hi.
Hi. Is Rabbi Eliezer the only person or the only rabbi that can perform these supernatural acts? Like we see in the Tanur Shalach Nai story, or that we see with the pew covers?
Okay, so that's a great question. You're noting that, right, in the Tanur Shalach Nai story, he's also performing kind of supernatural acts, maybe slightly different kind, but he's also performing that. Is he the only one? He's not. Rabbi Yeshua, in fact, also sometimes is presented as being able to do things like that. So he's not the only one, but it is perhaps noteworthy in the context of that story that there he does it and here he does it. So that was a question, right? Is that noteworthy or not? Okay. Any other clarification questions? Now's your chance. Yeah?
So his saying something when he's talking about the Kishuim, that when he does that, it's just like an utterance that makes this happen, or it's like about practice?
It sounds to me like it's a kind of, you know, Streganona? How many people know Streganona? Okay, this is, you know, about the length of the literature that I get to read, right? Streganona. Okay, so that's based on The Sorcerer's Apprentice. How many people know The Sorcerer's Apprentice? Even fewer. How many people know both Streganona and The Sorcerer's Apprentice? Okay, how many people knew that Strega Nova was based on sources of information? Okay, this is useless. Nobody knows what I'm talking about. Okay. Except for the select for you. Okay, so what?
It's just diminishing numbers as the questions went on.
Okay, in any event, I'm assuming. So this part sort of reminded me of that, right? Because first you make all the spaghetti go, but then you forget how to get it away, or you wash the floor, but you forget how to get the suds away, or whatever. But he can do both. I assume it's some kind of an incantation, right? Since we're talking about demonstrating magic. So that's what I'm assuming it is. But again, it's not so clear. Okay, any other clarification questions? I promise no more children's literature references. Maybe life is fine. Go ahead.
I just the basic meaning of the C paragraph. I'm saying, I've taught a lot, I've learned a lot, anyway, and then he says that I've not diminished from my teachers more than the God of see, and not diminished from my students more than.
No, and my students haven't diminished for me, right? Except for the amount that a mascara brush would take out of a mascara tube.
So is that a lot or a little?
Well, how much does a dip of a mascara brush take out of a mascara tube?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, there's two elements in each of these images, right? The dog laughing at the sea, there's the sea, which is like the biggest possible receptacle of liquid that we can imagine. Right, and a dog lapping up, which is not a lot. Right, however size dog you have, right, it's going to be a very small amount relative to the sea. Okay, so what he's saying is, I, with respect to my teachers, is like their Torah was like the sea, and I've only gotten as much as a dog lapping up. My students, with respect to me, so first of all, the receptacle is much smaller. It's only a makeup tube worth of Torah, right? Because I only have a small amount relative to the ocean of my teachers. But look how little they've gotten, right? They've only gotten out of that two, you know, one little dip of a mascara brush. So it's very little. And there's also a diminishing. So it's both that each one gets little from their teachers, but there's also a diminishing of the whole store from which you're dipping. Right? Okay. Anything else? No, it's all clear? Great. Okay, so here's now what you're going to do at your integrated tables. Okay, you have 17 minutes for the following task. Okay, I want you to simply discuss this story. Okay, if while you're discussing you find out that there really is something you don't understand, you know, yell or raise your hand and I'll come by, or you can come to me. Just discuss the story. Discussing might be raising questions about it, talking about what it's about, anything you want to discuss about it. And I'm going to ask the table, before you discuss each table, just to point one of you, which at the end of the 17 minutes, I'm going to ask each table to share one question or a thought or wondering, right, that emerged from your table. Okay? So you have 17 minutes to do this. Okay.